I'm tired of y'all. You come in to this neighborhood and you police it when you feel like it. And you think because you're at the top and we're at the bottom, you got us all figured out. We're all just thugs. But you don't know me. You don't know Miguel. You don't know what the hell is going on. And now you're trying to come into my house. Hold me up at my door, come back with a signature, or don't come back at all. I can't answer any more questions for you right now, sir. I got no answers. Can I go now?
This is Mouthful, and I'm Yvonne Laddie. Every week, I will be having a complicated conversation with a young person about the things that matter to them, things they have written about and shared on stages across the city. And then we will go out into the community and talk to teens, adults, experts, anyone who can broaden the conversation. It's hard to find a minority of any age who does not have a story about being stopped by police. And as we've seen in the news all too often in the last few years, sometimes these encounters are brutal, deadly. No matter how they go, all of them leave scars on the victims, their families, and friends. Here's one of my stories. I was on my first reporting job, sitting in my car eating a turkey sandwich. I had an interview on this all-white street, but I was hungry and decided to eat lunch first. Someone called the cops on me. They surrounded my car. I was a suspicious black woman in their neighborhood. It was so scary. Afterwards, when I told the man I was scheduled to interview what happened, he said, "That's awful. I'm sure they were just worried that you may have been watching the neighborhood for your boyfriend. We've had a few robberies." Huh? Was that supposed to make me feel better? But no one was talking about it back then. It was the expected. A part of black and brown life, you know? Fast forward to today, and not only do you hear the stories, you see them unfold on social media. You see the shootings, the beatings, the horror, the aftermath. You want to believe that mistakes happen, that policing is difficult, that ultimately police are trying to keep communities safe. But as soon as you're the one confronted by an officer for just being, it makes it difficult. And in communities of color, especially, the result is vigilance.
When I was a kid, the way I was taught to think about police officers was respect them, keep your distance, don't really interact because things could go wrong very quickly. And so that's how my mentality has been for a really long time.
That's Autumn Angeletti. She's a senior at Cheltenham High School, where she recently wrote a monologue entitled Neighborhood Blue.
It was because it was a requirement for a creative writing class. My creative writing teacher said that we should write about something that we've been thinking a lot about lately. So I chose to write about police in the community because that's what had been going on in the world.
And so we arrive at the topic of today's episode, community policing. Let's listen to Neighborhood Blue, performed live at the Philly Young Playwrights Monologue Festival by Ariana Sepúlveda.
I'd love to help you, but I got food on the stove, and I don't know what to tell you. Miguel? You didn't say anything to me. For the past few days, he's been getting up before I do, getting home after everyone's gone to bed. Our abuela's meds got pricey. He said he'd take on extra shifts, so no. I wasn't surprised when he started coming home with more money than usual. Was I supposed to assume his dumbass was going to go ahead and get shot? Dealing. I don't know anything about that, and neither does he. Even if he was dealing, cops don't regulate narcotics in this neighborhood. We're in a violent neighborhood. You got better places to be than here, all right? We got the block parties and neighborhood watch like everyone else. We just had one the other day with the bouncy house and everything. Oh, los negritos, the little ones, they loved it. I guess they you wouldn't know anything about that because you're not from here. Y'all are chasing a damn teenager down over what? A little yerba? Weed? Come on, are y'all really gonna lock up Miguel over some made-up charges or just kill him like you did with Sanchez? Hey, Sanchez was more of a mayor to this town than the clown y'all put into office. He held this town together, was everybody's Theo. Maybe he didn't handle everybody's dope, I don't know. But he spent the money buying kids arepas in the mornings and notebooks for school. That's the type of person he was, kind, generous. Y'all wasted 5 years chasing a damn philanthropist. Aren't y'all the ones tracking us in your little war on drugs? What good is a statement from me? Might as well take a statement from my 3-year-old son, too. As a matter of fact, how about you tell me this? How in the hell did little Miguelito, out of all the alleged dealers in this neighborhood, end up being the one to take a bullet to his leg? Who was after him? Who was picking a fight with a 16-year-old kid? And where were y'all all that time he was lying in the street in a pool of his own blood? Where was my phone call? Why did I have to hear about it from the family next door? Where was my phone call? Yeah, that's what I thought. Look, I'm tired of y'all. You come in to this neighborhood and you police it when you feel like it. And you think because you're at the top and we're at the bottom, you got us all figured out. We're all just thugs. But you don't know me. You don't know Miguel. You don't know what the hell is going on. And now you're trying to come into my house. Hold me up at my door. Come back with a signature or don't come back at all. I can't answer any more questions for you right now, sir. I got no answers. Can I go now? Ricky? Game's over. You can come out now.
The message, I think, is that from an outsider's perspective, people tend to dehumanize marginalized groups and those specific communities, and they tend to look at them in cases of poverty or like illiteracy, like lack of education, but there's such a strong community and a strong sense of humanity in every person that often gets ignored. So that my monologue is basically trying to showcase that humanity in the context of like the altercation between a community member and a police officer.
My producer Mitchell Bloom and I met with Autumn at the Creekside Co-op in Cheltenham.
I know a lot of people that have had really, like in this community, that have had really horrific experiences with police officers, have been held at gunpoint for trespassing onto someone's property, have been locked up because they've gotten into a fight. And so I still feel like the system is corrupt to the point where I'm still uncomfortable being around officers. However, I feel like I'm more comfortable around officers that look like me than officers that don't. So if I do need to be in a situation when I'm around police, I tend to migrate towards female officers or black officers or Latino officers because I just feel like they look at me and they see me and not like a bad kid running around doing something that they're not supposed to do or something that they're not doing anything wrong and they just don't look at me for who I am.
What do you hope people take away when they hear your monologue?
I hope people understand that particularly in marginalized communities, that there is a person behind every case. There is a background behind every story. Like, you don't ever see the full story. And there's a community behind every person because, you know, it takes a village to raise you. So I want people, when they, like, read the news or when they, like, drive through Kensington for whatever reason, that they are seeing people or attempting to see people in their full depth and not just the stereotype or the archetype that they've seen in the news.
What are your thoughts about all the violence directed mostly at young black men?
I feel like over time, over different administrations, there's been an increase in profiling and an increase in systemic racism for the purpose of creating profit. And so it's hard for me to see the integrity in stop and frisk. And it's hard for me to see the integrity in a lot of policing policies that we have in place today. And a lot of this, what Neighborhood Blue is about, is seeing the integrity in the work that you're doing and whether or not it really is meaningful to arrest a 16-year-old kid over a dime bag of weed, if that's meaningful work. And so a lot of the violence today does not feel like meaningful work. And I hope that maybe through my work and through the work of other young activists that we work to change these policies and change the structure of the system, because it's ineffective, and it's not for the purpose of creating better communities. It's for the purpose of profit.
Cops, like all people, are not all the same, and dealing with the bad apples is the responsibility of the brass. So we went to see legendary Upper Darby Police Chief Mike Chitwood. He's been in law enforcement for 53 years and was nicknamed Dirty Harry. Well, because he's a tough guy. But in his headquarters, there's a large mural of the diverse children of Upper Darby and police officers together. Community policing is a big source of pride for Chief Chitwood. When I asked him what he thought of the monologue, I held my breath and was surprised by his response.
I thought it was great. I thought it was a new wave of interactions with the community, and the community taking a life of its own through the recordings.
Were you surprised about what the young woman wrote?
Nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, I always take what somebody would say, somebody would write, somebody would videotape, and then I try and use my own life experiences as a guide. And so it really doesn't surprise me or shock me what anybody would say or do or record.
How do you train police to deal with residents whose lifestyles are different and cultures are different?
Well, Upper Darby is a very, very unique place. And I'll kind of go back in years. When I first became a police officer, there were three ethnic groups. There was the African-American black community, there was the white community, and there was the Puerto Rican community. That's it. That's all there was. Growing up, when I first became a police officer, because I can always remember, geez, I love to speak Puerto Rican. Not Spanish, Puerto Rican, because that's what you dealt with. And over the years, when you look at a place like Upper Darby, some 50-some years later, there's allegedly 52, 53 languages spoken, representing 65 countries. So it's a different dynamic. But people are people are people are people all over the world. The difficulty we have is, and I try and teach my officers through community policing, and I'll talk a little bit about that, is that most of the new arrivals in America are coming from countries that are war countries, that the military and the police are the enemy. The military and the police have suppressed, have brutalized, have murdered, have robbed, have raped, have pillaged the community member. Now all of a sudden they arrive in the United States and they're talking about you got to trust the police are good. You know, it's a kind of difficult thing when you're coming from that process. So we do a lot of interacting, and we start with the kids. First off, we have what I consider kind of unique. We have a mentoring program. So right now I have 40 officers in every fifth grade in the community, so in the public schools and in the parochial schools. And basically the officers go in once a month, once every couple, 3 weeks, and they just rap with the kids, talk about what the issues are, talk about what it is to be a police officer, your likes, your dislikes of a police officer. And it kind of gives a groundbreaking thing. We have a Citizens Police Academy. We have a Youth Police Academy. We do Coffee with a Cop. We do the school lockdown drills. We have bike patrol. We do bike radio. So my thing is that we got to interact and take part with the community members. You know, I'm a firm believer of quality of life. You know, everybody deserves a quality of life, no matter where they come from, no matter what their socioeconomic background is. Everybody deserves an opportunity to educate their children, to sit out on the step, to walk their dog, and to enjoy life, you know, and that's what our goal is. And I think sometimes we do it, but it's a constant, continual being out there, being present, being part of the community.
In the age of social media, when everything is on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat, when everyone is ready to point their cameras, there are a few places for bad cops to hide.
You know, policing in America today is like being in a fishbowl. Everybody's looking, everybody's got a video. I've never seen anything like it. And you got to be professional and you got to be able to deal with people. And sometimes that's hard to do. But I think leaders in the police community got to look at this emotional intelligence. Treating people with dignity, treating people with respect. It's not a big deal. And I'm telling you, the overwhelming majority of people that go into law enforcement go in there because they want to make a difference in their community and care. Are there mistakes made? Absolutely. Did we hire the wrong people? Absolutely. Like I told you earlier on, you know, we're human beings and we hire from the human race. We don't hire from some supernatural neighborhood that says, okay, you're a police officer, you're not going to do any wrong. You know, you are going to do wrong. You are going to make mistakes. And that's why it's up to leaders to make sure that the officers are trained, that you're hiring the appropriate people, and it's continual. It's not a one-time thing. It's continuous.
When we were mapping out the elements of this episode, we knew we'd talk to Autumn, and we knew we wanted to talk to someone in law enforcement. What we couldn't have planned was a conversation with Vashti Dubois and her son, Dubois Stewart. Dubois had recently been stopped and frisked by police for the first time. The experience had shaken both of them, deeply. So Mitchell and I traveled out to Germantown to talk to them about what had happened.
I was coming home from community service at Squash Marts. It was like the first time in like a few months that I'd ridden my bike. And I saw this car like tailing me halfway down a block, and I didn't think much of it. I didn't notice it until like a siren came on and then they told me to stop. I was pretty scared and I'd never been stopped and frisked before. They got out of the car. They told me, well, the first officer tried to start a conversation with me to make it easier, but it was scary nonetheless. He asked me to take out my identification, so I reached into my bag, but the other cop behind him reached for his gun, and the other one was like, actually, just let me take it off for you. And it was at this point that they finally decided to tell me why they stopped me, and this was because they had seen a suspect who looked just like me, or rather, they said looked similar to me, and wanted to know if I knew anything about him, or if I'd seen him anywhere. And of course I didn't. And of course the only thing in common was our dreadlocks. Everything else was different. This was a grown man. I don't even have any facial hair. And they questioned me for like 15 more minutes while his friend ran my ID through the records. And when they realized I didn't know anything, they let me go. I was terrified. I'd never been stopped and frisked before. I seriously thought I wouldn't go away unharmed because of all the cases I had recently heard of police brutality between black young males and police officers in general.
And how do you feel about this?
I was in New York City when this happened. I was at a friend's wedding from school. I got home at 1 a.m. And I was really excited to tell Dubois, like, yeah, this is why college is so cool, because you keep these friends for life. And, you know, it was 1 o'clock when I knocked on his door because I, you know, I could tell he was up. And he said, how was it? And I told him, and I said, well, how was your weekend? And he said, well, I got stopped and frisked for the first time. And I, like, I was speechless. I was fighting to not cry. And he said, don't cry. And I said, well, why, you know, why didn't you call me? And of course, I know why he didn't call me.
That's Dubois' mom, Vashti. She's the founder and executive director of the Colored Girls Museum. But as she sat next to her son, she was just a mom. Her body language spoke of a woman who would never, ever get over the fear of what could have happened and still could happen to her son.
And it's ironic because, like, the week before, we were on the baseball field and we were celebrating his acceptance to the University of Penn. We got that news on a Thursday, and then here it is. It's like Saturday morning. It's not even a week later, and it's almost like his official acceptance letter into, like, this next phase of his life is being stopped and frisked by the police because he's black, because he has locks, because he's a young man. It's just crazy.
Vashti had the talk with Dubois, the one all black parents must have with their children, the painful conversation on what to do if the police stop you.
After Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson that summer, Dubois was going into 11th grade. And I said to him, you know, listen, it's not a question of if this is going to happen. This is a question of when this is going to happen. And I want you to be prepared. So we need to practice, like, what you would do in this situation. And he was really angry at me. I remember that. Like, it's one of the first times, like, I kind of felt like a failure as a parent. And he pretty much said to me in that conversation, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, but, like, is this how adults, like, is this the solution adults have for this injustice, is to prepare us to, like, be violated? Is that, like, is that kind of like the best you can do? And he pretty much said, you know, if this is the way I have to live, I'd rather not live this way. And I was just like, all I could say was, like, I need you to come home. Like, when this happens, I need to know that I've given you every opportunity to come home to me.
Vashti loves her son. That was so clear. And when you love your child with all your heart and do everything you can to give him or her every opportunity, you don't want to ever think that all they are to some are just a black or brown face that equals trouble.
You know, the way that the news treats these things, you know, it's always the young man's fault or the young woman's fault. Somebody always did something. They looked away. They had a record. They moved too quickly. They did, you know, they looked threatening. I mean, my son, you know, is 18. I mean, you see him, like, you know, he's still becoming into his 18-year-old body. He's still, like, could easily pass for, like, 16, 15. So, you know, as a parent, like I said, it wasn't a question of if, it was just a question of when. Somewhere in the back of your mind, you tell yourself, oh, if they dress a certain way, if they speak a certain way, if they, you know, go to high school every day, if they get into college, if they're smart, if they're this, all these things. And the truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter. And then as a mom, like, it's just like your worst fear. And so now it's happened, and now you live with the realization that it can happen again, and it can happen again, and it can happen again, and then you live with that, and you just live with that.
The flip side to all of this is many of us, including Dubois, have had very positive interactions with the police, but it only takes one bad experience to embed a fear that will never end. He doesn't have much hope that the problems police and communities of colors face will go away anytime soon.
I don't know. I guess I don't think it gets better immediately. Progress is in a straight line. And before we reform the police department, we would have to reform our opinion of the police itself. Because in the eyes of the black community, the Latino community, the color community in general. Police are to be feared, and that can't be changed unless they see a story that differs from what they've already seen in the news. And the police themselves, they have to, I guess I'd like to see a system in which they don't allow certain officers certain rights, because some of them really just use their powers to their advantage, and I don't think those people deserve to be on the streets policing us if they can't police themselves.
And that's our show. It's college admission season, and so big congratulations to our playwright, Autumn Angeletti, who will be attending Howard University in the fall. Thanks so much, Autumn, for sharing your monologue and the conversation. Dubois Stewart is heading to University of Pennsylvania. That is awesome. Thanks so much, Dubois, for sharing such a difficult story. Thanks to Upper Darby Police Chief Michael Chitwood and Dubois' proud mom, Vashti Dubois. Neighborhood Blue was performed by Ariana Sepúlveda under the direction of Christina May. See you next time.
Mouthful is produced by Lisa Nelson Haynes and Mitchell Bloom of Philadelphia Young Playwrights. PYP is an arts education nonprofit that taps the potential of young people and inspires learning through playwriting. And by NYU journalism professor Yvonne Laddie, who also edits Mouthful. Original music for Mouthful was created by Ill Dudes. To join the Ill movement, head over to illdudes.com. That's illdoots.com. For episode extras and more information, visit mouthfulpodcastphilly.com. That's mouthfulpodcastphilly.com. And be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Mouthful Philly. Subscribe and review us on iTunes, Google Play, or SoundCloud to be sure you'll never miss a conversation. Mouthful is a production of Philadelphia Young Playwrights.